Hello everyone, and welcome to a new issue of the Boiled Leather Audio Hour, and it is a special occasion today that brings us together, because we are also celebrating, or I am celebrating to be more precise, the 50th anniversary of Stefan's Theory Hour on the Nerdstream Era. If you don't know it yet, check out the nerdstreamera.blogspot.com. Every Thursday I post some Song of Ice and Fire theories and my personal interpretation of those, and because it's the 50th anniversary, I brought two very special guests tonight with me to answer some of the questions that fans put in. And these guests are...
Hello, I am Sean T. Collins, as usual. I am the co-host of the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. I write the All Leather Must Be Boiled at BoiledLeather.com, and I cover Game of Thrones along with other television programs for Rolling Stone. And in celebration of this very special anniversary, I am extremely drunk right now. So I hope that's I hope that's cool. And joining us once again, I'm quite excited about that. He's become sort of our best supporting actor or something.
Hello, everyone. This is Amin, co-founder of a podcast of Ice and Fire, The Lord of Kingsgrave, and Hand of the Queen.
Ooh.
Got some titles this time.
Yeah. They really ups your game. You know, we should all find titles. titles are great. We will be doing this a bit like my regular theory posts, and if you are not familiar with them, they go like I get a question from some fans, and that I elaborate on the subject, usually in a bit bloated and convoluted form, but hey, that's the format, and that's what we will do here too. And the first question that I had on my list and that we will be covering today is, what is the meaning of trial by combat, and does it mean that the gods exist? So, Sean, what's your take on the topic?
I think that Martin's position about the gods is pretty explicitly articulated both within the text and, if I recall correctly, in interviews. I think he takes an agnostic position. I think, obviously, we're dealing in a fantasy world where supernatural forces are at play in verifiable ways, but I don't think that it then follows that even the gods posited by characters who seem to have a successful magical relationship with those gods, for lack of a better word, is necessarily accurate to the cosmological situation. I've said this a million times, but obviously of the religions that we've seen, followers of R'hllor seem to have the most power, and then followers of the old gods seem to have powers of their own. But the old gods is sort of a separate issue, because now we sort of have a firsthand indication of exactly what's going on there. But again, they're not gods in the sense that anyone would recognize. Even polytheistic religions in the real world don't conceive of gods that way. And with the red god, like, I've often wondered if, you know, people observed these various supernatural phenomena at work in the world, and in order to explain them, devised this personification of those powers and you know, concocted R'hllor. There's nothing stipulating that just because Melisandre attributes her ability to create shadow babies and glamours and see the future in the fires to a deity means that that is in fact the case. So I think when you look at trial by combat, which appears to be an accepted method of trial across faiths, but is best associated with the faith of the Seven, I think that it's pretty clear that it's not meant to be dispositive regarding the existence or non-existence of the gods. You know, on a narrative level, the whole point is that this is kind of ridiculous, right? I mean, Tyrion is innocent of the charges. He did not kill Joffrey, but he's found guilty because Oberyn takes a little too much time to crow and not enough time to deliver the killing blow. The Hound is guilty of murder, the murder that he's accused of, but he walks because he just happens to be better in a fight than Beric Dondarrion. You know, Tyrion is found not guilty because Bronn defeats Ser Vardis, and he was in fact not guilty that time, but it hasn't... I mean, it very clearly has nothing to do with the gods. That doesn't mean that it proves the gods don't exist, but it does mean that this ritual is empty.
I agree that he's made his world agnostic. I mean, unlike, it's not like Dragonlance or some fantasy world where you know there's gods. And I like that about what he's done there. And I thought it would be interesting to look at some of the trial by combat. So those are the three main examples that we've seen in the books. I mean, we also have from Dunking Egg, there was a special one, 7-on-7.
Right, right.
There. Is that it?
Well, that's an extra interesting example because Dunk prevails, but since it's not 1-on-1, all sorts of people,
yeah,
even on the winning side, can die in that situation and do. And, you know, it affects, you know, by everyone's account, you know, the person who dies is one of the best people and best leaders in the realm. And it's a horrible tragedy. So it just seems bizarre to imagine that, like, well, this is, hey, that's justice for you. That's the gods making sure that the right side prevails. You know, like, okay, so they save this, you know, upjumped squire who wasn't even actually upjumped. And then, you know, one of the greatest men in the realm dies. And that's obviously the irony that Dunk himself wrestles with at the end of that story. So yeah, it's an interesting case.
But one of the best partnerships that came out of that, Egg and Dunk, came out of the cost of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
We will see whether it was worth it or not. Yeah, the verdict isn't out yet. We still don't know about Summerall. So my take on it is that it is yet another part of the deconstruction of fantasy tropes that Martin is doing here. Because, as you already said, the ritual is totally empty. You know, it borders the ridiculous in some cases and the tragic in others, especially in the Trial of the Seven. And it really does nothing of the sort that it is supposed to do, and it is just another shot at the dismantling of the noble knight myths that are around. And I guess a glaring example that we haven't touched yet is Cersei's upcoming trial, because when she sits in Baelor's Sept and is counting her options and thinking through what she can do, trial by combat comes up a lot. And the consideration of the guards and who's innocent or guilty doesn't even come into the equation. It is just a question, do I have a guy that can beat the other guy? And if I don't have, I simply can't do trial by combat. And that makes this whole thing so empty, so twisted in a sense. I think that was the main goal why it's so prominently in the narrative.
Now, in the Sandor and Beric fight, when his sword breaks, you're just saying that was just chance kind of thing? There was no meaning in it?
I don't know. I really don't know. I am not in the camp of people who think that Sandor Clegane will fight Gregor Clegane in Cersei's trial. So I think he will stay on the Quiet Isle, and I would attribute it to pure chance, yes. Okay, then let's just hop to the next question, and that one is, will John get more point of view chapters? So just in the off chance that you don't know what a point of view chapter is, it is when your chapter starts with John. So what do you think? I mean,
that's a good question. I mean, I hadn't even thought about the possibility of him not getting it. I mean, we all know that he's coming back. Like, that can't be the end for him. There's so much evidence put in there on how he could stay temporarily in Ghost, or Melisandre could bring him back, or whatever. But why would you say he wouldn't be in a POV chapter? Because if he dies and comes back, he knows too much about what happens at that kind of point?
I think it's, you know, people refer to Catelyn Stark dying as a POV character, and then upon her return, she has no more POV chapters as an example of how this thing is supposed to work, or whatever. But even, I think that's a choice on Martin's part. I mean, we've seen post-mortem points of view from, or a post-mortem point of view from Varamyr Sixskins. At the end of his chapter, his prologue, he's dead. He's in the body of one of his animals. So that, that doesn't, just because you die does not mean that's the end of you as a sort of subject that can be, who has thoughts that can be chronicled. I mean, we've already seen a counterexample. I think that the choice to remove Catelyn's point of view has more to do with, that's more of an aesthetic choice or a thematic choice than it is some kind of firm statement about how people who've died and returned are going to be treated in the series from that point forward.
But I'm very, very positive that we will get new John chapters, because there is so much that has to be done on the whole story arc and the character arc of John. If you want to know what, check out the Myrinese Blood. It is really an incredible blog, and he explains it very well. And we need John chapters for this. It is possible that the initial John chapters will be named different. You know, like the Lord Commander or the Resurrected Body or Ghost or whatever. Ghost is, I think, a very strong possibility, yes. Something like that. But we will definitely go back to John and get POV chapters of him. Whether we will enjoy them like we did the last ones is another question for another discussion. But I am very, very sure that we will get some.
Yeah, and that just seems to go without saying, almost.
Yeah,
it's good to say.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I love John. Really, it is. John is what brought me into this whole essay writing and fantasy theory thing. So I'm pretty glad that he will most likely stay in. So let's go to the third and last official question for today. And this is one I have to read in its entirety. And it goes as following. I just read a theory whereby Eddard Stark is still alive. The evidence given was Arya not recognizing him at his execution, Sansa not recognizing his face on a spike, Catelyn thinking his bones are too small. If you add this to the offer Varys makes, whereby he will read a letter Eddard will write for Jon, makes me believe that Varys may have strung him free, as Jon could easily be an ally of Daenerys, as the dragon must have three heads. End of theory. So, Sean, is Eddard Stark still alive, spirited away by Varys?
Eddard Stark is not still alive. No. Eddard Stark had his head cut off in front of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people, in front of Cersei, Joffrey, the Hound, the Kingsguard, Pycelle, Littlefinger, Varys, both his daughters. No. Eddard Stark is not still alive.
Well, technically, it's possible. Eddard Stark is not still alive. But it's not what happened. I mean, like, if you wanted to say, like, is there a scenario where it could have happened? Well, if you have somebody, like, we know people can change faces. So if somebody could match his face and take his place in the cell, it could happen. But there's no reason.
Is there a Jaqen H'ghar is actually Eddard Stark theory? Because maybe there should be now.
Oh yeah. I have another evidence. In the show, we don't see Eddard die. That and D&D have been known to talk to Martin, so they surely are up to something. Really, there has to be some connection.
I think I read this somewhere, somebody mentioning this, but in the books, Bran talks about how he puts on the face of a lord or the face of, like, his dad, so he can put on different faces.
Cool. I mean, if I would get a dollar each time someone mentions that character X is secretly a warg, I would have money by now, you know. That is great. Mm. But I think this is a very good moment to talk about why this theory and many like it are so unlikely. Because just think about it on the narrative level. If Ned Stark would still be alive, everything this series is about would instantly be turned on its head. Eddard Stark being killed is, up until the Red Wedding, the most pivotal moment of the whole series. It is what defines Game of Thrones as what it is. So if Ned Stark is still alive, Martin is the biggest troll in history. Really. No, there's no other way to say it. And I don't think that he wants to be his legacy be that. No way Eddard is still alive. Everyone else, but not Eddard.
Hmm. Isn't he like? Yeah, he talked about, like, how he planned to kill Eddard from the very start too. So even in terms of, like, his intent, he said that as well.
Yeah, there's absolutely no chance. This is the core of Game of Thrones, really. So no chance.
Yeah, none at all. None at all. And that's, you need to pay attention to. I say this all the time when we talk about the more elaborate and extreme and outlandish theories. You need to pay attention to what the books are actually about. The books are not about Frey pies or any of the sort of deeply hidden things. They're, you know, they have the themes that we address all the time, the things that move everyone and involve everyone who reads these books and watches the show, you know, thing, power and violence and, yeah. you know, and ethics and the place of women and the place of the small folk and all these things. It's don't put the cart before the horse just because Martin has been tricky a few times and has subverted the way narratives work a few times. Like, he's subverted them, but he hasn't just stopped writing a narrative in favor of doing, you know, a Sudoku that you solve. And then that's not the point of these books. It's not the point of fiction. If it is, you're kind of doing it wrong. So that applies to a lot of things, not just whether Eddard is alive, although that I've never heard a theory that combines being completely outlandish with completely undermining like one of the core moments and core goals of the entire series. But, you know, just when you're on the hunt for clues, and when you're looking for, you think you found some mystery, you think you found some hidden meaning, like, just try and stop for a second and think, does this make this a better book or just a more clever one? And in a lot of cases, it's neither. But if it's just clever and not, it doesn't contribute in any meaningful way to a development of those themes, if it's only good for talking about on in a common thread or a forum, it's probably not the case.
Yeah, it would be like a written form of Lost, you know, just mystery for the sake of mystery without any meaning behind it, without anything that drives it beyond the next mystery to be solved. And there is a downside to our approach of reading the books, and it can't be denied, because it is a little bit arrogant of us to say it like this, you know, look at what book you are reading, you know, read what it's really about. Because if we are wrong, of course, and that's always a possibility, then our whole approach goes down. I have repeatedly in my theory posts and in my essays rebuked many fan theories, like, for example, the theory that Jane is still pregnant with Rob's child and spirited away by the Blackfish and stuff like that, because it seems to me that it would subvert the narrative that I find in the books. But of course, I could be wrong, and then I would stand like an idiot. So there's always this possibility.
That actually parallels Tywin's death. And when you first read the first few books, people often think Tywin was the better option, ends justify the means. But through A Feast for Crows, which kind of shows Tywin's legacy, and A Dance of Dragons, which shows Ned's legacy after their deaths, that's another reason why Ned needs to be dead, so Martin can show you the legacy of the two characters.
Which allows me to bring in a little advertisement, because the new preview that Mark Linehan's brought out for Blue Buddha Press, it includes an essay from Stephen Attiwell about just this issue, which is really brilliant. So you should go check out the preview as long as it's still available for free.
Read as much as you can about this stuff, you guys. Everybody, please, listening.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we'll be out of our non-jobs.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's go on to the last two of our theories we want to do today, because these three were now submitted by readers to my blog. So they are part of the usual program, but Sean and Amina are here, so they can put in two theories of their own choosing. And I'd like to go on with Sean, who has one theory that is, in my view, a little bit under the radar and should be talked about more prominently in fanhood. So Sean, if you would just elaborate a little bit on the topic.
Sure. That is very, very kind of you to say, Stefan. I have to say, like, it was also quite a pleasure to participate in this, like, live action version of the thing you do on your blog every week. That was fun. We should do more of that. But there's no way for me to, like, do live action podcast versions of posting a bunch of sexy pictures of Natalie Dormer like I do on my blog. So
yeah, that's
too bad.
What are you going to interview her? By the way,
I have interviewed her. I guess yeah. I probably still have that recording. I suppose I could post that. But hey, all right, future podcast ideas. I feel like that one would do really well on iTunes.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, my theory that I guess I don't know that I came up with it, because I'm not a person who comes up with theories. It's just not – I'm not sharp enough usually. So I suspect that I
– Hello?
No.
I think he just dropped out.
I think he dropped out. Somebody didn't want him to share that theory.
Oh, yeah. There is a problem with this call, Skype says. So, yeah, I recognized. So let's jump to the next theory here, and let's rejoin Sean later if he can make it.
Sure.
And you, I mean, also have a theory we can talk about. So elaborate on your subject, and if you now drop, there is a conspiracy at work.
Sure. My theory was suggested by F.T. Ward from a podcast of Ice Fire listeners. What he did is he looked at some text descriptions in A Dance with Dragons of Melisandre when she's having kind of her like visions and that sort of thing. And he compared it to text descriptions in the second book when she's giving birth for the shadow baby that murdered Sir Courtenay Penrose. And he looked at the text and saw how it was very similar in Clash of Kings. Blood ran down her thighs, black as ink. Her cry might have been agony or ecstasy or both. And then in Dance with Dragons, blood trickled down her thigh, black and smoking. The fire was inside her in agony and ecstasy. That inspired him to think, well, maybe there's a shadow baby in the fifth book. And then he sort of started to think, who was the father, number one, and who would be the target? And potential fathers would be Stannis, potentially, John, potentially, or maybe the Davos's son who's acting as a squire. And then potential targets. Will, we're trying to figure that out. Sean is back.
I'm back. Hooray.
Hooray
for me.
Jumped to the shadow baby theory, and he's just explaining it, so we get back on yours later.
So have I told you the shadow baby? Like, did you already read it? Because then we could just jump to discussion of it.
No, I read it.
Okay, then we could just jump into it. So yeah, what do you guys think?
Huh.
I, you know, my first thought upon reading it was that it relies too much on the idea that George R. R. Martin wouldn't unintentionally repeat word choices and phrases, which I think is demonstrably untrue in dozens of ways. You know, just because he describes the blood running down her thighs and agony and ecstasy in similar ways about the same character twice, I don't really think you can draw much of a conclusion from that at all. Words are wind, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I also think it is a bit problematic to go only on such small details. It's the same problem I have with the Janie Hibbs theory, because it rests on such a slim base in a choice of words that could really be an oversight on Martin's part, because he isn't really known to be always 100% precise with that stuff. So that is a little bit problematic, but for the sake of it, let's just accept that Melisandre really spawned a shadow babe, and let's talk about the two interesting questions that would arise from that fact. Because the first one is, who made it with Melisandre, and who is the target? And I think the theory points to three people who could be possible fathers: Jon Snow, Devon, and what was the third?
Could have still been Stannis, depending on the timing. We don't know how long
Mance,
they get
Mance, Mance it was. Okay, then we have
four.
Actually,
you're right. Mance, sorry, yeah.
Yeah, we can also put Stannis in, but I want quit John out of it as soon as possible, because John never ever. We would have got a glimpse of it in his later POVs. There's no chance of it that he never thinks of having slept with Melisandre.
Unless he wasn't aware of it. He was just, because there's a line where she basically like fondles his wolf and is controlling his wolf, which is like an extension of him. But that could just be foreshadowing of what's going to happen, I guess, with his body.
It's possible, but it doesn't seem really likely to me. I don't know.
But it wouldn't be against, like, something like against the narrative if it's something that happened off screen near the end of the book, like as part of his deal to get his sister. I think she even says, like, she offers, like, I can help you get his sister. So
yeah, you're right. It could be possible. Okay, so I take it back. John is a possibility if we accepted Mance, of course. Why not? And Devon, possible. Nothing speaks against it. Nothing speaks for it. I mean, it's Devon. It's not really a character we know.
Like, he has a crush on her, and he's available, and he's young, so he could be used. But he doesn't have royal blood or anything, though.
We don't know what the rules for shadow babies are, so it's hard to say how she chooses her lovers. But based on that she used Stannis before, it seems it should be a powerful person. So I think that rules Devon out a bit.
And another idea that was suggested was Stannis said he had nightmares, I think, like really regarded after the shadow stuff. And then Mance has like descriptions of nightmares, specifically with Melisandre, I think. Let me see that.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, so who is the target?
Well, one option is to do something at Winterfell. I don't know the range of a shadow baby if it can get down there. That's if it's to do something in Winterfell or to do something beyond the wall, I guess would be the two targets.
Winterfell would be Little Walder.
Roos or Ramsay probably would be targets, but I guess like we haven't seen it happen. Like we just don't know enough about shadow babies. It seems like it would just have to happen that night, though, right? I don't think you can hold it for like a long distance or a long time.
Yeah, so I think the wall is more likely. And on the wall, we know of no one who died under suspicious circumstances at the narrative time of the book. So it either happens off screen and it is not someone we know, or it happens immediately after John's assassination, right?
Hmm. Or it doesn't happen at all, which is where I'm leaning.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not on the boat with this theory. Yeah, I'm just going along for a second.
There's one interpretation that's interesting. Does magic that Melisandre uses, like the sexual magic, like does it have to be to create a shadow baby, or can it be used for other purposes? Because then it could match the description, but just be the magic being used for something else, like seeing Blood Raven or like seeing visions. Like then we don't know enough about it to make a call on that.
Well, I mean, who's Thoros fucking? No one, right?
Yeah, but they've been doing like different kind of stuff, right? They've kind of different streams.
I guess so, but I mean, I don't know. I think it starts to be like, you know, maybe
he's been with Beric, right?
Sure, and Makoro is buggering various Iron Men.
I think the Shadow Baby is really a different
the Shadow
type of beast.
Yes, yes, that's I think that is the extent to which sex is required for what Melisandre does, and obviously the show kind of complicated the issue by having her have sex with Gendry and then place leeches on his erect penis to extract King's blood from his unit.
But we saw his six pack, so that makes up for it.
Some of this, I think some of the reasoning behind this theory, if you look at the original post, is this person is alleging that Stannis had no idea what he was doing when he was having sex with her, which I think is cockamamie. And we actually made fun of this in passing in the last episode, you know, the idea that he is not voluntarily coming to her bed. Like, what? Sure he is. You know, sure he is. He may not have been thrilled with the idea at first, but, you know, they're sharing a tent, aren't they?
But Stannis would never cheat on his wife.
It is not cheating. Wife, right. His wife is probably the one that got him there. So
I agree.
I think he will find ways around it.
Yeah. Listen, he's already a kinslayer. So let's not. There's a tendency to treat Stannis like he's Eddard Stark. He's not. You know, I mean, Stannis ruthlessly prioritizes his loyalties and his code of honor. And, you know, Stannis's primary goal is, I am the king. I must do whatever it takes to make that true, you know, in practice as it is in theory.
He will have such a meltdown when Daenerys comes.
Hmm. Yeah, you think so?
I think, yeah.
Some say he will
question what he's doing. I'm pretty sure. I don't think that Melisandre will revise her interpretation of him as Rollo. I think he as Azor Ahai. I think he will do it. I'm pretty sure of it because he is the guy that is able to put aside thought like I am the savior and messiah to, oh fuck, I'm just a rebel, so I have to deal with it accordingly. You know, he's the guy who can do that. Melisandre is clearly not.
And we pretty much know that he's going to be around. Like, I mean, that's one of the things about prophecy, the fact that he's swept aside when Dany comes or she has to deal with him. We know that he's going to be around till then. That's like one of the things we know.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. Oh, that's a great point. Because I'm getting a lot of questions. I haven't answered any asks in a while, but I'm starting to, you know, people are starting to talk about, will he lose the Battle of Ice and Fire?
No,
you know, the Battle of Ice. No, he won't. He will not lose the Battle of Ice.
I just got another idea as we were talking about the Shadow Baby thing. It could be tied in with the general rule of magic that we have learned so far, that only death can pay for life. It could be the other way around in these cases. Only life can pay for death, you know? If you want to kill people with this Rollo fire magic thing, you have to, quote-unquote, celebrate life first. So that's why the sex part is in it. Because neither Makoro nor Thoros of Myr ever try to kill someone. So it's logical that they don't have sex. But Melisandre uses this power to kill, and so she has to take this life somewhere. And I mean, Stannis is pretty exhausted after it, and he has nightmares and stuff. So that ties in with the general motive about magic use.
But if this theory were like true, or if it were happened, would you be disappointed, or would you find it interesting? Like, let's say if it actually existed.
Depends. We just don't know enough to judge it yet.
Moving on to Sean's.
Basically, yeah, I think Oberyn Martell poisoned Tywin Lannister, and I went through the books and found like a lot of what I feel to be textual support in terms of means, motive, and opportunity. He was taking dinners with Tywin Lannister. We learn elsewhere in the book about the poison widow's blood. It shuts down a man's bladder and bowels until he drowns in his own poisons. Oberyn is making vaguely threatening but plausibly deniable statements regarding Tywin's mortality to Tyrion. Tyrion shoots him in the bowels, which I don't know how much you can really read into that. It may just be timing, but then, you know, his body goes rotten in a way that is, striking and notable and disgusting, even to people who are accustomed to the funereal practices of this particular level of technology and culture. And a final thing that I thought of later, when Elio and Linda rejected the theory, was, there was two things. They first questioned, one of their objections is if you've taken poisons that shut down your excretory system, that's not going to change when you die. I kind of don't think that's true. I think that, he gets shot in the bowels, so it's going to release whatever is in them anyway. It really has nothing to do, and all that waste material is still being produced.
Yeah.
It just isn't, it's just not being eliminated. The other thing that made me think that maybe there's something to this is Prince Doran obviously has been playing the long game for a very, very long time. And he tells to the Sand Snakes that your father and I worked more closely than you know, ... So it seemed like Oberyn and Doran, despite what appeared to other people to be their differences, had been working together for quite some time. So it just seems unlikely that Oberyn would sort of call an audible. That's not what I mean. What I mean is that actually this is one thing that kind of complicates my theory. Doran is saying that he wanted Tywin to witness the ruin of his house.
Yeah.
So then it becomes a little bit tougher to believe that Oberyn would poison Tywin before
but it's
that
not,
could
like,
be accomplished.
Even though they worked closely together. I mean, because that's a factor. It's not like they had to be 100% the same agreement. Like, Oberyn might have acted on his own or hastened things because he seemed to be talking about, like, crowning Myrcella, and that's something I'm not sure Doran wanted to do. So they might not have been 100% like parallel on their goals, but they were still supporting each other.
Right. And I mean, and also there's some room for improvisation. I mean, obviously he didn't go to King's Landing with the intention of dueling Gregor Clegane, but the opportunity presented itself and he took it. Yeah, basically my theory is that this poison is the reason why Tywin's body decomposed so grotesquely and was so smelly and disgusting. And, so that's my theory. I should say that when I've talked about it, when I talk about a lot of theories that I subscribe to, if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. And I think that's also an important thing to keep in mind when you are playing with theories in these books. Like, if you're wrong, you're wrong. Life goes on. So it won't affect my enjoyment of the books if I'm wrong, and it'll be neat if I'm right, but it won't really impact my enjoyment of the books if I'm right either, or if I never find out.
The reason why I said that I find this theory is a little bit under the radar and that it deserves more recognition is that I really like the irony of it. The knowledge that Tywin is already dead when Tyrion goes out and shoots him and creates such a haywire of it, that he will die regardless of what happens, that all these plans are stacked on each other and then shot at the bowels and Varys' plans and Illyrio's and everything is a fucking haywire. And it wasn't necessary because there was the master plan of Doran Martell, the man of master plans that always don't work out, is here in case it is just such a fucking irony. It really fits into the larger picture, especially of Doran's plans. It would just fit in nicely.
Yeah, and he had the opportunity to do it as well. I mean, he even had breakfast with them, right? I think.
Yeah, yeah. Which is really careless on Tywin's part, I have to say.
And it wasn't Mace Tyrell there too? That must have been an interesting breakfast.
Oh, yeah, possible. I don't remember it. But still, it is the Red Wiper we're talking about.
He even mentions it, like, he's like, when Joffrey was poisoned too, he's just like, I'm like the guy you'd think would be poisoning people. Thankfully, you're under suspicion for that one.
Yeah, I think the poison is so slow working, perhaps, that Oberyn hoped to escape scrutiny. I don't know.
Because he did slow the poison on his spear too, right? So they have ability to kind of change it up, make it, maybe he made it even slower than usual.
Yeah, it might be. Okay. So that's why I like the theory.
Yeah, I think I cited it in A Flight of Sorrows to Sean. So
there you heard it first in A Flight of Sorrows. Okay, just to close the episode, I would do one last quick shot without any comment of the other two. So each of us should reveal what he or thinks what will be a twist that comes up in The Winds of Winter. This was a question that was also posed on the Nerdstream Era, and I liked it, and I think we should just throw it out there, not comment on it anymore. We leave that to our readers, and I would simply use it as a closing statement, so to speak, and start with Amin.
I gotta think about this, though. Someone else start first.
Okay, Sean, do you have to think about it, too, or can you fire away?
I would need to think about it. Oh, my goodness.
Okay.
Put me on the spot.
Here's one. Here's one right away. Okay, so, like, at the end of the fifth book, we think people are firing catapults at the city outside of Dany's.
Yeah.
City. So they find out that... Isn't Dario hostage at that point, or he's not?
Yeah, he is.
Yeah, so they fire Dario over with the catapult, and he dies.
Whoa.
That's it.
Okay. So I will give Sean some additional time. I think the most revealing twist will be Dany going a real, real dark turn, you know, becoming something like a villain figure on a hell-bent quest for revenge with fire and blood. Sean, now it's your call. You have to.
What is the question again?
Come up with a plot twist in the next book. And I have another one here I'll mention. I don't know if it's a plot twist or a prediction, but I think that... Can we talk about spoiler chapters in this episode or not?
I don't care.
Okay.
I don't care. Just
it's the one that we did. If you listen to the blog, we've done this one before. It's the one we did last year. Stannis reveals that, like, you may hear that I'm dead. I think he's going to fake his death. He's going to fake his death and use that as a military advantage. But that's what unintentionally causes, like, people to think that he's dead, and that goes to John.
Well, I think we've already seen him do that, which is the pink letter. I think Stannis is the author of the pink letter.
I think he wrote it indirectly. Like, he didn't actually write it.
He is the person who oversaw its writing. Right, yeah.
Oh, really? Actually still wrote it. Like, because I don't think he meant for that letter to go to the wall. I don't think he meant that. I think that was an accidental irony of what he did. I thought he meant to, like, influence Ramsay and Roose, and then they took that information and sent it to the wall. So, yeah, we'll see about that.
Good. Then I will leave it up to our readers to make what we just discussed, what could come out of The Winds of Winter. And I thank you all for listening. I thank you two to join me for this special episode. And you heard it first on the Nerdstream Era. Bye.
Hooray! Bye-bye.
See ya. The shout out for the podcast awards now,
of course.
Yeah, sure, go ahead,
put it in.
Okay, so right now A Podcast of Ice and Fire has been nominated for entertainment category for podcast awards at podcastawards.com, and they have daily voting until November 15th.
Yeah, vote. I did.
Cool, thanks.
Which one do you like better, Eddard Stark still alive or Varys and Merling?
Oh boy.
I don't even know the Merling one at all. I mean, I guess you'll describe either one to us. So, yeah.
What is even the theory? He walks around on land.
Yeah, I don't. It is so fucking stupid. I think it is done as a joke. I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah,
that's the problem with it. I just post the link again.